Court appointed, is that correct?
Yes.
We appreciate your taking the appointment and your good support for your client. We'll move on to the second case of the morning. The Derek Searcy versus Danny Jeanette. Ms. Hoffman?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Lisa Hoffman, Assistant Attorney General, here this morning on behalf of the respondent. On October 15, 2002, the District Court granted the writ of habeas corpus in this case, holding that the State Court's analysis of petitioner's Confrontation Clause claim was so erroneous as to be unreasonable. The issue before the court this morning is whether, in fact, the district court erred in that assessment. Before a writ may issue, a federal court must find that the challenged state court decision is either contrary to or an unreasonable application of the United States Supreme Court precedent. Under that now familiar standard of review, it is not sufficient that a federal court find the state court decision incorrect in its point of view, but rather the AEDPA requires that a state court decision be unreasonable. And the United States Supreme Court in Williams versus Taylor has characterized that as something like lying well outside the boundaries of permissible differences of opinion. This is not the case here. The Confrontation Clause guarantees a defendant the right to effective cross-examination. That is not disputed in this case. The United States Supreme Court has held, however, repeatedly that that right to cross-examination is not without limitations, and they have repeatedly given to the trial courts wide latitude in determining what reasonable limits they might impose on that right to cross-examination. That right is not a black and white rule. There is discretion. And in this case, the state court's exercise of the discretion cannot be deemed outside the realm of reasonableness. In this case, the petitioner wanted to cross-examine two state witnesses, Clarence Johnson and Michael Brooks, about the possibility of a motive for them to have killed the victim, Edward Bowman. Had it not been for the very tenuous link in a long chain that the petitioner needed to demonstrate in order to get to what might be a motive for Brooks and Johnson to have committed the murder, this might have been a much easier case, but it was not. The trial court recognized that when petitioner sought to ask the question about motive and bias of Brooks and Johnson, that he was in fact injecting speculation into the trial, and the court was concerned about that injection of speculation and conjecture, and in fact determined that that line of questioning would be confusing to the jury. It's important to understand that in this case there is an affidavit of a police officer that was brought in on post-trial motions that supports the idea that is what petitioner wished to use to support his idea that there was motive. The police officer had engaged in an arrest of the victim sometime prior to his murder. On the date of the arrest, the officer's affidavit attested that the victim had indicated that the police had the wrong guy, and he had in fact indicated that they should be going after Mr. Brooks, who dealt drugs in the area. The officer's affidavit indicated that there was another person present in the apartment at the time of that arrest. That person might have been within earshot of that comment.
His name was Boyd, wasn't it?
Boyd.
Yeah, there are two Boyds, and I guess they're not related.
There's a Boyd that was actually a relative of, a son of...
They're not related, is it?
No, I don't believe so. At least the record doesn't indicate that.
Well, the police officer testified that Boyd was present, didn't he?
The police officer's affidavit said Mr. Boyd was present in the apartment. He did not suggest what the closeness was. also in that police officer's affidavit was a statement that after the arrest, police entered into negotiations with Mr. Bowman about serving as an informant against Mr. Brooks and Mr. Brooks. It's important that when you look at the affidavit, that paragraph regarding the informant does not relate to the activities that happened in the apartment. Officer Washington does not suggest that the negotiations that he entered into with Mr. Bowman before his death to act as an informant were had in the apartment. In fact, the way the paragraphs in that affidavit are set out, it specifically suggests that the comments about "you got the wrong guy" were had in the apartment. Those might have been overheard by Mr. Boyd. The informant information, the fact that Mr. Bowman apparently spoke to police about possibly becoming an informant, he did not become an informant before his death, but that those comments were not made in the presence of Mr.
Boyd. Of course, he was informing when he made the statement, wasn't he?
Well, I suppose he was suggesting that they've got the wrong guy, although it's difficult to say informing when, you know, having not been arrested, I'm not sure, but I think it's quite possible that people being arrested tend to try to throw the blame elsewhere. Faced with that list of maybes, if this, then this, and then the trial court said, it's impossible for us to have a basis for the motive here. This is confusing. It's going to confuse the jury, and I'm going to disallow this line of questioning.
Now, that motive, without it, would preclude, I guess, the other things that were actually brought out. But it would, as I understand it, the problem was that the man was shot, I guess, 7 times. Some of the shots at point blank. The pathologist, I believe she was a pathologist, testified that one of those shots would have killed him instantly. Yes. Brooks testified reported eventually that when he got to the victim said something groaned like, "I'm not going to make it." In other words, he said something. And that flies in the face. So it's obviously only Brooks would know, but isn't that really what he was trying to show, that Brooks would have a motive? And I wonder just to what extent that line of defense he would be able to get in if he couldn't explore what we'd call a remote possibility that word of mouth got to the fact that Bowman was going to be an informer.
And if I can just that last statement that you made, I think is one of the things that is confusing, and I think the district court got that wrong, and I want to make sure that that's clear here. Again, there was never an assertion on the part of Officer Washington that anybody was, that the conversation that he had with Mr. Bowman regarding informing was had in the presence of anybody. The way the affidavit is set out, it says, Mr. Bowman said, "You've got the wrong guy." And then the next paragraph says the above reference statement was made in the apartment when there was another person, Mr. Boyd, present in the apartment. The next paragraph, or maybe even two paragraphs down, he then states that there were later negotiations about informing. So my concern is just that we not confuse what was actually basis there actually might
have anything to do with the question you were asked,
though. Well, so back to the question, and with respect to how could he prove that? Certainly, Mr. Brooks' testimony was suspect. He was discredited by the testimony of the doctor. He was discredited by there was some credibility questions with respect to both Mr. Johnson and Mr. Brooks. By Ms. Anita Mills' testimony, she stated, "I bought drugs from these people. They dealt in drugs. On the day of the murder, I saw Mr. Brooks and the victim in some kind of an altercation in the alley outside of the petitioner's home." Those things all discredit the witnesses. And if the question is, were they the best witnesses? Certainly not. But I guess the question here, and might the petitioner have been able to go on a long journey of speculation and thrown some kind of question about their motive into the mix? There's no question, had he been able to go down this road, there would have been all sorts of confusing information in the record. But the trial court determined that because he could not demonstrate a basis for a motive, In other words, he didn't have any reason to believe that Mr. Brooks or Mr. Johnson knew that the victim was working
at the company. The only evidence of that, though, is that they were questioned in the outside the presence of the jury, and they said, well, of course, we didn't know anything about this, right? I mean, it's just their word against somebody else's.
Their word and the lack of any other evidence.
There wasn't any evidence that this did not get back to them except the fact that they denied it. Isn't that right?
True. There wasn't.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to ask one follow-up on that quickly. Out of the presence of the jury examination, they also, I guess, in denying, said, no, I didn't know anything about that. It was an informant, which is pretty much the obvious answer, I think. They're not going to say, yeah, I knew it. But wasn't there also some question about drugs, and Mr. Brooks got rather distraught, and the judge had to tell him to calm down? What was that about?
And the record doesn't reflect why Mr. Brooks was distraught. The district court certainly speculated that indicated some guilt on his part or some uneasiness with the idea of motive on his part. However, I think that's extraordinarily speculative. Mr. Brooks might have been, as any person would be, distraught over being accused of being a drug dealer in a court of law, or any other number of things. So the fact that he was agitated is a fact that happens to be in the record. I think that the district court makes much too much of that fact in light of the realm of possibilities for why any person might become agitated when being accused of being a criminal when sitting and testifying in a court.
Our closing argument in this case really leaned on the credibility of those two witnesses, didn't it?
And they had reason to do so, because obviously the credibility of the witnesses had been the state's case. I think we all can agree the state's case was not phenomenal in this situation. We have a number of people all involved in the drug trade, all involved with one another at various times, and obviously they put on these two witnesses, and Ms. Mills made testimony to discredit the experts. Had medical testimony that discredited the state's witnesses. So I think in closing argument, when the state's trying to prop up its witnesses, that's nothing more than simply...
Didn't the closing argument, though, emphasize the lack of motive? That was the important thing here.
They did mention...
This was an effort to show motive. That really was the only issue in the case, wasn't it?
And Mr. Searcy was unable to demonstrate motive in this case, and so I think that closing argument was... And again, the fact that he was unable to demonstrate motive wasn't because the state precluded him.
He was unable to demonstrate because they wouldn't testify that they knew that this fellow was an informant.
And again, the state court has to have discretion to determine when it believes that cross-examination is going off in a direction that's going to create confusion and speculation, and that's what this court did. And when you look at the cases that the petitioner and the district court relied upon, they all have one really important difference, which is that in those cases, the basis for the motive was absolute. It was a fact. It was known. Unlike this case, where we have to jump through a number of hoops even to get to what might be a basis for motive. Had Mr. Searcy, had there been more information with respect to motive, perhaps the decision of the trial court would have been different. But in this case, I do not believe that you can find that this decision was unreasonable.
Is that true of Olden as well?
Pardon me?
Is that true of the Olden
case? I think it's extremely true of Olden. Because in Olden, what happened was we had the witnesses at issue were both the victim who testified and her, at the time of the incident, her boyfriend, and at the time that she was testifying, her cohabitant. And the question was, they had been having an affair at the time of the rape or the alleged rape, and they were living together by the time of trial. And the question is, did she have motive to lie to him on the night when she came home from what she claimed was a rape and what the defendant claimed was consensual sex? Did she have a motive to lie to her boyfriend about where she had been and what had happened to her. And again, that was back in the record.
You only got a
there are no further questions. I'll reserve for rebuttal.
Okay. Mr. Wayne?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Steve Winger of General Block. I represent Petitioner Appellee Derek Searcy in this matter. Your Honors, Derek Searcy was convicted of murder without being given the opportunity to effectively challenge the credibility of the state's critical witnesses against him. The testimony of Brooks and Johnson was the only evidence tying Mr. Searcy to this crime. The state produced no physical evidence tying him, linking him to the murder, and in fact, some of the physical evidence that was presented at trial, as Your Honors noted, directly contradicted Brooks and Johnson's story. Accordingly, Brooks and Johnson's credibility was the central issue in this case. As the state just admitted as much, the case was extremely weak unless the jury would be convinced of Brooks and Johnson's credibility, the state had virtually nothing. Nevertheless, the trial court prohibited Mr. Searcy from attempting to show on cross-examination that these witnesses were biased against him, despite the fact that the factual predicate that Mr. Searcy offered in support of this cross-examination is largely undisputed by the state. The district court later recognized Mr. Searcy had a strong claim of actual innocence. The defense's theory at trial was that Brooks murdered Bowman with Johnson's assistance, and that both were testifying falsely to implicate Mr. Searcy in a crime that they committed. In support of that theory, the defense produced an eyewitness, Tanita Mills, who placed both Brooks and Johnson at the crime scene and directly implicated them in the murder. The defense also produced the sworn testimony, the testimony of a Chicago police officer, which, as the state noted, was later offered in the form of a sworn affidavit. The police officer stated that Bowman had been arrested 3 months before his murder. At the time of the arrest, he implicated Brooks as a drug dealer in the presence of Clinton Boyd, Johnson's neighbor, and at the time of his murder, he was working out a deal to become an informant with the Chicago police. However, the trial court refused to allow Mr. Searcy to ask Brooks and Johnson whether they knew about Brooks' informant activities, strictly because Brooks and Johnson did not admit on voir dire to having such knowledge.
They had denied that. Let's just say they went to trial and they denied that. The question is, when do they get around to asking that question?
Exactly.
The question or the last one, huh?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is it going to be the first question or the last question? When you're examining Brooks.
And yeah.
I don't know how they would arrange that, but I guess the trial judge was concerned about if they say no, I guess it's all the other examination that goes with it. I don't exactly know what they were trying to keep out in addition, but they were going to give the same answer, I presume.
So if he says no, you're saying what?
What follows from that, and what would?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not
be the next question that they were not able to ask.
Well, as Your Honor mentioned, it would depend on how the examination was structured, and more fruitful examination may have followed. We don't know. But even if they led with it, that question, and Brooks denied it on the stand, as Your Honors were discussing, his demeanor, we have record evidence that he became so agitated when asked the pivotal question that he had to be told to restrain himself and to calm down.
He when asked that question or some other question?
When he was asked the question, did you know that Brooks had told the Chicago police that you dealt drugs? When they asked that question, Johnson became so agitated that the judge had to tell him to restrain himself. Now, as the district court noted, had the jury had the opportunity to view that demeanor, given the centrality of Brooks and Johnson's testimony to the case and the complete lack of other evidence against him, that alone might well have substantially influenced the verdict, have changed their view of his credibility. It might have led them to disbelieve his denials. And again, given the fact that as the state just admitted they had nothing else, we think the jury was entitled to make that determination. On opening argument, the state argued that Brooks's demeanor was not very probative because anybody would be agitated if they were falsely accused of dealing drugs and someone told them that the police knew that they dealt drugs. Well, that may be true, but our position is, Your Honor, is for the jury to make that determination. It may be that he was just agitated because he was an innocent man falsely accused, but it equally well may be that he became agitated because he was the killer and he was being exposed on the stand. The jury was entitled to make that determination. And again, given the centrality of this testimony and of that witness's credibility, that alone, we submit, made this severely prejudicial. The taking that away from the jury severely prejudiced Mr. Searcy's defense.
Was there any evidence besides this woman, the drug user, that Brooks dealt drugs? Any evidence besides that? Did anybody ask him that, or were they able to?
Well, he denied it on voir dire. But Brooks.
I mean, before the jury.
Before the jury, no. Brooks's testimony.
But he wouldn't allow any questions on whether or not he was a drug dealer.
No, that was admitted as well. The defense also wanted to get into that issue, but that was also excluded in limine by the trial court. Your Honor, we submit that. In addition, I should note that on voir dire, aside from Brooks's demeanor, some of their substantive responses, Brooks and Johnson's substantive responses, actually supported the defense's theory of bias. Brooks admitted that he knew Bowman, the victim. Johnson admitted that he knew Bowman as well, and also that he knew Clinton Boyd. And he admitted that he may have had conversations with Clinton Boyd between the time of Bowman's arrest and his murder. Now, taken together, this is an extremely strong factual predicate. This shows, number one, that it's undisputed by the state. They don't dispute Officer Washington's affidavit. So we have proven, effectively, that that Bowman informed on Brooks to the Chicago police. The affidavit clearly says that in the presence of when Bowman implicated Brooks, Johnson was present. And we also, from the responses on voir dire and from Tanita Mills' testimony, we've established that Bowman's a drug dealer. He's implicated.
No, you didn't. Wait, I just want to clear. You said when Bowman implicated Brooks, Johnson was present.
I'm sorry.
You meant Boyd.
Clinton Boyd was present.
Yeah. Okay.
So, in other words, not only have we established that we have the victim implicating Brooks, we've also established that it's quite possible that Johnson and Brooks could have learned that fact. And we further have established that, from Tanya Mills' testimony, that they had at least an opportunity to commit this crime, and may well have committed this crime. Now, together, this is an extremely strong factual predicate. And contrary to the state's suggestion, the defendants in Davis, Oldham, and Van Arsdale were not required to submit anything stronger than this. The state claims that the motive was definitively established in those cases. And if you look at those cases, that's just not true, Your Honor. First of all, our factual predicate was just as strong as anything in those cases. Again, undisputed that this snitch had occurred and that the victim was informing on Brooks. Secondly, we had a good faith predicate for the fact that that Brooks and Johnson could well have heard about this. To ask us to do more than that is to far exceed the predicate that was required of the defendants in any of the Supreme Court holdings. And we submit that it was an unreasonable application of those cases for that reason.
What did the voir dire disclose, if anything, that shows it should have gone in on direct testimony?
That it should have gone in?
Should have gone in as direct testimony.
Well, it showed that Brooks knew Bowman. Okay, it showed that Johnson knew Bowman and Boyd. And that's a critical fact, that Johnson admitted not only to knowing Bowman and Boyd, but to perhaps having conversations with Boyd. The jury should have had the opportunity, even if he denied having substantive conversations with Boyd about the critical issue.
But that knowledge was never made available to the jury then?
No. So, number one, Your Honor, we submit that this is an unreasonable application of Davis, Van Arsdale. Davis, Van Arsdale, and Olden. Those cases hold that if a defendant has a solid good faith factual predicate, the court can't completely foreclose all inquiry into witness bias, particularly where, as here, the witness's testimony was the only evidence against the accused, and where without the proposed cross-examination, the defendant would have no other way to get his theory of bias before the jury. But also, the procedure used by the trial court and affirmed by the appellate court of Illinois was contrary to the Supreme Court's holding in Alford v. United States. Alford holds that a defendant must be allowed reasonable latitude to conduct exploratory cross-examination. A defendant cannot be required to prove in advance what his cross-examination will establish. Well, that's exactly what happened in this case, Your Honor. The court said on the record, he used the word prove. The court said, Mr. Searcy sought to expose their bias by asking them the question before the jury, did you know that Bowman was informing on you at the time of his death? The trial court said, on the record, I will allow you to go into that only if you can prove in advance the very facts you're trying to elicit on cross-examination, only if you can prove that Brooks and Johnson actually knew. Contrary to what the state says, this is not a case where The defense was trying to engage in wild speculation or pile inference upon inference. We weren't trying to get some completely groundless innuendo before the jury. We were simply trying to ask the state's critical witnesses whether they were aware that an event had occurred, an event that the state concedes had occurred, and an event that was highly relevant to the defense's theory of bias. Now, under those circumstances, Your Honor, again, particularly given the centrality of Brooks and Johnson's testimony, the Supreme Court cases are very clear that we should have at least had a minimal opportunity to conduct exploratory cross-examination, to ask that question in the jury's presence, did you know that Bowman had been informing on you, and to allow the jury to observe the demeanor. Which brings me to to the question of harmless error, Your Honor. The standard on collateral review for harmless error is that an error cannot be deemed harmless if it has a substantial injurious effect on the jury's verdict. It's important to remember that under the governing Supreme Court case law, the state bears the risk of doubt on this issue. That means that if after reviewing the entire state court record, this court is unable to determine whether or not the error had a substantial injurious effect, then it must affirm the district court's ruling. Well, some of these factors have already been discussed, but under the circumstances presented here, Your Honor, the trial court's error was clearly not harmless. In fact, as the district court recognized, it severely prejudiced the defense and warranted the granting of his petition. First of all, Brooks and Johnson's testimony was absolutely pivotal to the state's case, as I've noted. The entire case hung on their credibility. Anything that would have the potential to undermine that credibility would necessarily have an impact on the jury's verdict. Secondly, the testimony was not cumulative of any other testimony. The proposed cross-examination was the only testimony that had the potential to expose bias. Now, the state noted in their opening argument that the defense had ample opportunity to undermine Brooks and Johnson's credibility, sort of suggesting that this line of questioning that we tried to pursue was superfluous. That's just simply not true, Your Honor. This court has made clear in Redmond that there's a distinction between general credibility attacks and attacks that go to bias. Without this line of cross-examination, we were unable to put before the jury any plausible motive for Brooks and Johnson to commit this crime. And without that, our bias theory had very little to hang on. We had no ability to really to bolster our bias theory before the jury. So this was not cumulative. This was the only line of questioning that had the potential to expose Brooks and Johnson's bias. Also, there was no physical evidence, as I've mentioned, corroborating Brooks and Johnson's identification of Searcy as the shooter. In addition, as Your Honors noted, the autopsy evidence flatly contradicted critical aspects of their stories. The cross-examination that was otherwise permitted in this case was inadequate and unable to establish bias. It focused on general impeachment, general credibility attacks. And finally, as the state just admitted, the overall case against Mr. Searcy was extremely weak. In addition, there's record evidence in this case, as we've discussed, of Brooks's demeanor. Brooks became so agitated he had to be told to restrain himself. As the district court recognized, had Brooks exhibited similar agitation in front of the jury, that may have been dispositive. And at a minimum, the jury should have been given the opportunity to witness his demeanor when asked that question and to gauge its significance for his credibility. Again, given the centrality of their testimony, that might have changed the outcome of this case. Finally, Your Honor, the prejudice here was compounded by the state's arguments on closing. The state, as we discussed in our briefs, the state made several hyperbolic statements in praise of Brooks and Johnson's credibility during its closing argument. It called Brooks and Johnson heroes. It even went so far as to say at one point that they were, quote, probably two of the most credible people ever to walk into a courtroom, end quote. In addition, it specifically drew attention to what it called the defense's inability to suggest a plausible motive for Brooks and Johnson to lie. And finally, it expressly pointed out Brooks and Johnson's demeanor as powerful evidence of their credibility, knowing full well that the jury was robbed of the opportunity to witness Brooks's outburst on voir dire. Well, thanks to the district court's ruling, the defense was left with no effective way to rebut these outlandish statements. This had two effects. At first, as the district court noted, it diluted whatever general impeachment or credibility attacks the defense was able to perform, and it simultaneously gave an artificial boost to the state's case. It bolstered Brooks and Johnson's credibility in the eyes of the jury, and it made it more likely that the jury would believe Brooks and Johnson's version of the events over Tanita Mills' version of the events. And I would just I would just point out one final point, Your Honors, in that the state makes much over the affidavit, makes much of the point that that in the affidavit, Officer Washington did not say that Clinton Boyd actually could have heard Bowman's implication of Brooks. Well, as Your Honor pointed out, he actually did implicate him as a drug dealer. The affidavit says clearly that when he did so, Boyd was close enough to have heard. So that point seems to me to be utterly irrelevant. And I guess my time's run out, Your Honor.
Okay, fine.
Thank you.
You just got about a minute left. You want to say anything else, Ms. Austin?
We have discussed the contrary to and the harmless error arguments in my brief, so I will direct you to that. So with your permission, I'll just conclude by saying that this case isn't on direct appeal. This is a habeas case, and in order for the petitioner to be successful in a writ of habeas corpus, he has to demonstrate that the state court applied United States Supreme Court precedent to the facts of his case in an objectively unreasonable manner. We submit that he cannot do so in this case. Therefore, the decision of the district court granting the petition for writ of habeas corpus should be reversed. Thank you.
All right, thanks very much. The case will be taken under advisement. Mr. Winger, is it safe to assume that you accept this appointment to do this? Did you accept an appointment to do this, or is this a pro bono effort on your? Yes. Well, we thank you for your vigorous effort on behalf of the fund.